You're listening to Pythagoras' Trousers.
Hello and welcome to this month's Pythagorean Astronomy with me, Chris North. Over the course of the next month, we're going to see the arrival at Mars of not one, not two, but three spacecraft. There's NASA's Perseverance rover, with its little helicopter Ingenuity. There's the Chinese space agency's Tianwen-1 mission, which comprises an orbiting spacecraft, a landing platform and a rover. And there's the United Arab Emirates HOPE mission, which is an orbiting spacecraft. Later in this episode, we'll be hearing about these upcoming missions to Mars, and I even managed to get a bit of insight into the Chinese space programme. But there are two amazing things to note, at least I think there are. Firstly, if all three are successful, this increases the number of missions in orbit around Mars from 6 to 9, with HOPE and the Tianwen-1 orbiter joining three NASA spacecraft, Mars Odyssey, Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter and MAVEN, two European spacecraft, Mars Express and Tracegas Orbiter, and one Indian spacecraft, Mangalyaan, or the Mars Orbiter mission. On the surface, meanwhile, the number of missions will double, with Perseverance and the Tianwen-1 lander and rover joining NASA's current lander, InSight, and existing rover, Curiosity. The second thing to note is that the three new missions represent three very different stages of a space agency's exploration programme. Perseverance is the next step in NASA's long-running and, by and large, incredibly successful Mars exploration programme. Tianwen-1 is China's first full mission to Mars, but builds upon the significant experience of landers and rovers on the Moon, which have also largely been a great success. And HOPE is a much smaller mission, representing the United Arab Emirates' first interplanetary mission. Actually, it's pretty international, funded by the UAE, but with a number of US institutions involved, and it was launched on a Japanese rocket. Certainly quite a haul of missions, though it's not actually that surprising to get them all at once. The relative motions of the Earth and Mars mean that launch windows, the periods when launching is most efficient, uses the least fuel, come around once every 2 years, coinciding roughly with the time when Mars is closest to the Earth, which happened towards the end of last year. These missions, for example, all launched towards the end of July 2020 and took around 7 months to travel around 150 million miles in their long, looping orbits to Mars. But while missions arriving together isn't that unusual, it is the biggest batch for a while. The last time three missions arrived together was 2003, and future plans only include one or two missions every launch window. The Rosalind Franklin rover, a European-Russian collaboration, with a rover being physically built here in the UK, is set to launch in 2022, and there are Indian and Japanese missions due to head there in 2024. Of course, a perfectly sensible question is why all the interest in Mars? It's a dead planet now, or certainly pretty dead, and perhaps that wasn't always the way. To find out more, I thought I'd speak to someone who works as part of a team planning a Mars mission. Dr. Peter Forden is based at the Open University, where he works on the imaging cameras of the Rosalind Franklin rover, due to launch in a couple of years. Peter's area of expertise is the geological history of Mars. On Earth, we can dig up rocks, or go to a cliff, perhaps by a beach, and look at the layers of rocks, studying the order in which they were laid down and taking samples all the time. But what about on Mars, when we can't get so up close and personal with the rocks ourselves? Well, it turns out, it's not so very different after all. Peter began by explaining how we explore Mars's history and what we know about it.
Well, it's interesting you should mention sort of standing at the beach and looking at the layers of rock, because on Earth, our understanding really does come from looking at cross sections, so stacks of rocks where we can see down in deep in through time what's happened in one place. On Mars, it's all sort of top down. So trying to understand what has happened when is much more difficult than trying to understand what has happened where. On Earth, trying to do geology, the whole surface of Earth has been resurfaced many times throughout its history. The plate tectonics, the movement of the plates in plate tectonics sort of resurfaced the Earth, whereas Mars hasn't had that. So we do have a record all the way back through time on Mars.
So that gives us this in some senses, that's nicer than the view on Earth, because we haven't had the surface completely refreshed. I mean, that is one of the frustrations about Earth, is that everything is buckled and bent and so on. And looking at the history can be a challenge. On Mars, on Earth, I know when you look at a stack of rocks, you can sit there and say you can time it by how far down you're going in the rocks to estimate the age of the layers. As you said, on Mars, the when is difficult. Do we have any handle on the when of what's happened on Mars in terms of its rock formations?
We do have a handle of when. So throughout the solar system, impact cratering is a process whereby over time impacts arrive on a planetary surface. On Earth, they are removed by all the geological processes. But on Mars and the Moon and other planetary bodies, there's a record of impact cratering. And you can use the sort of size distribution of impact craters to get an idea of how long a surface has been exposed to this sort of incoming bombardment that happens over time. And so you can look at this sort of size frequency distribution over different areas to sort of get a handle on which areas are older than others. But that doesn't tell you the absolute age of anything, but people have used these size frequency distributions from the Moon, and where we have some absolute ages from radiometric dating of Apollo samples, used the models and our understanding of the distribution of meteorites meteors in the solar system, tied that to Mars. So sort of a bootstrapped method of getting a handle on when things have happened with some absolute ages. But the error on those ages is still huge. On Earth, if you were sort of doing some geological dating, you might expect the errors, and you might sort of know when something happened within a few, either maybe a few 100,000 years or within a few 1,000,000 years is a reasonable kind of ballpark. Whereas on Mars, like, you will probably know things within if you've got an error of 100,000,000 years, people are going to be like, that might be a bit too precise. You might just be making it up. So it really is sort of orders of magnitude different to Earth. But because there's been so little that happened on Mars and it's been spread out through its time, we can still pin down when some really sort of major events have taken place throughout its history.
So can you give us a brief history of the geological evolution of Mars?
Okay, so to start with, Earth and Mars are very similar. Once the crust had sort of stabilized and there was a crust, Mars experienced a series of very large impacts, which created what's known as the crustal dichotomy. This is where the northern hemisphere is a bunch of massive great pits superimposed on the surface. And so the north became lower topography and the south became much higher topography. After this is the Noachian period, named after Noah and the rains. And this is the time period when valley networks and big river channels are seen on the surface. Now, this is, when we say seen on the surface, these are the ones that have been preserved. So this means that at this point, or since this point, nothing has happened that's removed them. So this is like, there may have been lots more sort of wet geology happening before them, these big channels, but then these big channels occur and nothing else happens after them. This is at about sort of the end of the Noachian and the beginning of the Hesperian time. The Hesperian time is in some ways a transitional period. This is when the climate of Mars has shifted from having any kind of sort of thing that's favorable for life through to becoming much more cold, dry, and acidic. In the Hesperian, is characterized by really large volcanic plains being formed, a volcano that's sort of a flat volcano the size of France forming over 100,000,000 years. And then nothing has happened to destroy that since. On Earth, that sort of something like that has happened on many occasions, but they're completely destroyed within tens of millions of years. Throughout this sort of Hesperian period, though, there is good evidence for there being sort of periodic episodes of lakes. In fact, Gale Crater, where Curiosity is, that lake there was active and had water in it in the Hesperian, but there probably wasn't a sort of globally integrated hydrological cycle, really. Then the Hesperian sort of ends, it sort of peters out, and there is a few sort of large flood events which created the sort of giant outflow channels. Nobody really knows quite where the water's come from. Some suggest it's stuff that's been sort of underground, frozen in permafrost, that's defrosted because of volcanic activity, or it's ice caps that have sort of melted suddenly. But either way, these represent sort of the last big events before the Amazonian. Now, the Amazonian is what Mars has been like for the last 3,000,000,000 years. And it's basically been a cold, dry desert. The only things that have really happened in the Amazonian is ice-related processes, CO2 ice-related processes and continued volcanism. But the volcanism has become more and more sort of focused in a couple of specific areas rather than sort of widespread, like it is sort of on Earth today.
The Amazonian period sounds like it's the exact opposite of the Amazon rainforest here on Earth.
Yes, it is.
Now, we've got various missions and rovers and landers and orbiters and so on that are exploring Mars and mapping Mars, as you say, doing the top-down views of the surface. But the mm-hmm. rovers and the landers have given us a bit of an insight. And there are two there at the moment that are operating. You mentioned there's Curiosity Rover, which is in yep. Gale Crater, and then InSight, which is this lander which doesn't move around. Now, after having quite a few years of a load of rovers going to Mars, taking a lander and it not moving around might seem like a backward step, but actually that's pretty important for what InSight's trying to do, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. And it might not be as sort of as glamorous as a rover, a nuclear-powered rover with a laser, but it's doing some really fundamentally important science. And it needs to sit in one place. It needed to go to somewhere as boring as possible to do that, because it's trying to listen for earthquakes or Mars quakes, which is incredibly important in our understanding of the planet. I think that we sort of perhaps take for granted that we understand that the Earth has a crust, a mantle, it's got a core and an inner core. And these are all, you know, we know what where they are, and, you know, what they do, and can use that to understand the processes on the surface. But in Mars, we just don't really have a handle on what that structure is and sort of the details of it. The crust could be 10 kilometers or it could be 200 kilometers. Are there, you know, how big is the core? We just don't know. And so InSight was sent to really try and answer those questions and see what's going on in Mars, and, you know, is it still active, you know, tectonically on the surface?
I know one of the things it was also trying to do was to measure the surface with something they called the mole, which is perhaps inspired by Thunderbirds, I'm not sure, with this mole digger that dug underground. That, unfortunately, they've hit a bit of a snag and have now abandoned attempts, I know, because the ground seems to be harder than they expected.
Yes, it was the wrong sort of sand. It was there wasn't enough friction in the sand, so their sort of self-burying mole couldn't continue down as it sort of buried itself. I had a little look recently about sort of just how this was meant to be working, and it's a shame because they won't be able to get the heat flow measurements that they wanted. But in doing what they did, they've learned a lot about the soil properties and, you know, what they can and can't do. So next time there's some drilling or there's, you know, another attempt to get into the subsurface to, you know, do something with the heat flow measurements, they'll, you know, have a huge amount more understanding of the surface, really.
Now, as well as Curiosity and InSight, there are quite a number of missions on the way there. Let's focus first of all on the NASA mission, which is called Perseverance, which is kind of like it's not quite a carbon copy of Curiosity, but it's a similar kind of idea as Curiosity, similar design of the main rover. Now, Curiosity is in Gale Crater, which is kind of an equatorial-ish region. InSight, this static lander, is further north, as I recall.
A little further north, still quite close to the equator, but yeah. Okay.
Where's Perseverance going to go, and what are we? Is that going to give us a different insight into Mars's history from what we've got so far?
Yes, it is. So Perseverance is going to a place called Jezero, which is another impact crater, and this is close to the equator again, on the edge of between the northern lowlands and the sort of southern highlands, really. And Jezero Crater is, I think, most interesting and important because it has in it a big sediment fan, a delta, which is the strongest evidence we have so far of there being a standing body of water there, of there being a lake there to start with. Now, Curiosity has, you know, discovered that it was in a lake bed in that crater, but the Jezero Delta is older and has a much more diverse array of minerals seen from Earth, and also is connected to the rest of this Isidis Planitia, the area that it's adjacent to. So understanding where the sort of how deep the water was and how long this delta was active will give us a really good understanding of a more global part of the sort of hydrological cycle on Mars a little bit further back in time.
So it's definitely going to tell us different stuff. Now, there are other missions that are on their way. There are also, what we haven't touched on yet, we haven't touched on the orbiters. So there's a flotilla of spacecraft going around. Is it six now going around Mars? And we've got two more on the way. We have Tianwen-1 from China and this mission Hope from the United Arab Emirates. So that takes us to eight missions orbiting Mars, which is an incredible thing to contemplate. What do we learn from orbit that you maybe can't do from a rover or a lander on the surface?
That's an interesting way of putting that question, because normally, because it's posed the other way around, what can you do on the surface that you can't do from orbit? I think from orbit, you get the perspective of the whole planet, potentially. And whereas a rover, you're very limited to only one kind of place, even if you can go sort of kilometers over, you know, however many years. Whereas the orbiters, you know, can see everywhere and everything. Also, the array of different instruments provides all sorts of different types of measurements. So, but the instrument that from TraceGas Orbiter that I've used most is the Cassis instruments. This is a color stereo camera. So it can build 3D models from the data and it produces excellent color pictures. And that is particularly interesting because the orbit it's been put in means that it quickly covers the whole planet. So you get at different times of day. So any particular point on the surface will be, you know, the camera could photograph it sort of twice in 30 days. It takes lots of images and it moves around. So this allows them to try and sort of watch seasonal effects and effects that happen on a diurnal cycle over between night and day. Whereas other orbiters are on different orbits that give them only a fixed time of day when they'll be doing overpasses to collect data.
So yeah, as you say, a huge variety of data. Now, there's two things that I think are interesting about Mars right now, and maybe you may be interested in very different things, but the two things that tend to be of interest to people at the moment, at least that hit the press, are the presence of two key things on or under the surface. The first one is water or ice on Mars. For the last decade or two, every few months there's a new discovery of water on Mars, it seems, in some new way, and looking at it, maybe this is a subsurface ocean or a deposit of ice or water potentially trickling from craters, all this kind of stuff. What's our current understanding of where water is on Mars, if there is any?
So where the water is today, well, the main reservoirs of water today are frozen. The poles both have caps of water ice that are then covered by seasonal caps of CO2 ice. There are also sort of probably some subsurface ice deposits in the regolith. And there's also lots of evidence for glacial deposits. So sort of basically lumps of ice stuck on the surface between mountains. And some of these look like they've just sort of sat there for probably hundreds of billions of years. And others of them have been sort of active and have, you know, there's evidence that they've flowed at times when, well, the ice has flowed at times when the climate has been sort of conducive for it. That's really where ice is today and where water is today and where water has been for throughout the Amazonian period.
And as you said, before that, water was pretty much everywhere. I mean, we think that Mars was a pretty wet place back in the Noachian period and so on. It was very wet, right?
Yeah, well, I wouldn't say sort of very wet. I mean, you'd be disappointed probably if you were to expect it to be wet all the time. I think that it was very wet at some times, but throughout a lot of that time, it was still just locked up in ice. There's quite a big debate in the community between sort of was it just all stuck in ice and it all melted sort of once, or whether there was a warmer and wetter climate, and how to disentangle those two sort of end members of like an ice house or a sort of, you know, occasionally soggy ice house.
So, and that's, I guess that's something that is hard to infer from the data we have, unless you start, is that something that digging down beneath the surface might allude to? We can go to rocks all longer ago, or is that something that we're going to be scratching our heads about for quite some time?
I think we're going to be scratching our heads for a while, but it is something that rovers and digging down to the surface and looking at cross-section really tell us about. So as I started, as I mentioned earlier, sort of you've only got this sort of top-down view, really. It's like having a birthday cake where for planetary scientists can, and you know, using orbital data, you can look at the top of the birthday cake and you know exactly whose birthday it is and how old it is. And you know what the icing color is. You have no idea what the cake's made of or whether it's, you know, how many layers it is. Is it a chocolate cake? Who knows? Whereas on Earth, you know it's a chocolate cake and you know it's got a jam layer in the middle, but you have no idea whose birthday it was to start with because you can't see the top. And so the rovers will allow us to sort of, yeah, see into this layer of cake and hopefully be able to find some sort of sedimentological evidence for water and water doing things. As I mentioned, with Perseverance going to Jezero crater where there's a delta. So if this delta has, you know, and the lake there has been deep enough to produce the right sort of sediments, that means that actually maybe the water extended much further. One of the things that the ExoMars rover, which I work on, may or may not find, although it's not sort of part of its primary mission, is that if it finds some kind of evidence for like lake sediments or sediments that have been deposited in a standing body of water, because of where that landing site is sort of geographically, it sort of has the implication that there must have been a much, much larger, perhaps a sea on Mars at the time that those sediments were deposited.
And so let's touch on that. So you mentioned ExoMars rover and where it's going. So this is one of the things I know you've worked on is where ExoMars, the Rosalind Franklin rover should go. How does one decide where to send a rover on Mars? Because it's a big planet and the rover can only observe a tiny fraction of the surface. So there's presumably a lot of debate, argument about where's the best place to go.
Yes, there was a lot of debate and discussion about the best place to go. The ExoMars rover, Rosalind Franklin, is specifically trying to find evidence for past or present life, which is, you know, a mammoth task, really. It's very much sort of a needle in a haystack, in a field of haystacks, kind of without a magnet kind of task. But so picking where to go to land, sort of picking which haystack to search in, is really hugely important. But it's basically fundamentally driven by the engineering constraints of the landing systems. You can't do anything if you crash. So we start to try and work out where we could go and to land. We started out with a map and then immediately ruled out the areas that we couldn't go to. So areas that were where there wasn't enough solar energy to run the heaters to keep the thing warm enough to operate, where areas where there wasn't enough atmosphere and the elevation of the surface was too high. It had to have enough atmosphere for the parachute systems to be able to slow it down enough. And with these constraints, that sort of left a sort of a narrow band really around near the equator, which from that we then had to sort of look at the rocks and understand, look at what we knew and try and follow the mineralogical and geological evidence to find somewhere that might be good. It's the same sort of process that all the rovers have had. In fact, many of the landing sites that we looked at are ones that had been previously looked at for other missions. And the same is true for like Perseverance and Gale. There's been sort of landing sites which, you know, have been sort of not quite selected several times throughout all these different processes.
And so where's Rosalind Franklin going to land? What area is it going to land in?
So the Rosalind Franklin is going to land in a place called Oxia Planum. Now, this is a flat plain, which is good for landing on, rich in clay signatures, so mineral signatures of clay. So this is where spectrometers in orbit have seen minerals on the surface where there's clay minerals, which indicates water interacting with rock in the surface. It sits between the sort of southern highlands, which are much older, and the northern lowlands, which are sort of much younger. And it has a sort of a sediment fan at one end. It's not as well preserved as Jezero crater, but it's still there. And it's an area where there seems to have been a lot of erosion, sort of possibly hundreds of meters of sediment material have been removed from it, which means that the strata that we're looking at, the layers that the rover is going to be sort of drilling into with its drill to take samples, represent material from this sort of earliest period in Martian history, from the Noachian, which is very exciting.
And that's just because you've gone lower down that sort of geological history, or areological history, I guess, of to go to the lower layers that you just can't sample. You can't dig down 100 meters, right? Or tens of meters even. So you have to...
No, so you had to go somewhere where those sort of oldest terrains were preserved and had been... So the oldest terrain, but also recent exposure, because the rover is looking for biosignatures. And as we, you know, Mars has a very unpleasant radiation environment. So sort of potential biosignatures or biomarkers, which I'm sure that Louisa will talk to you in great depth about, they need to be sort of, have been exposed to that irradiation environment. So if the surface has only been recently re-exposed, then they will be more likely to be intact, giving the rover a better chance of identifying anything in there.
Now, the one thing I want to touch on very briefly at the end is that one of the possible biomarkers that's talked about an awful lot is methane as a potential. So one of the potential sources of methane is biological activity from microbes and so on or beneath the surface of Mars. But there are other explanations as well. This is why methane is not a perfect biomarker, is because there are other possible explanations that are kind of geological or geochemical in nature. What are the non-biological explanations for methane on Mars?
So that geology can produce methane in numerous ways, but one of them is the association with a process called serpentinization. Now, serpentinization is the process where you take a mineral called olivine, which is very, very common on Earth. It occurs at the mid-ocean ridges. It's one of the basic building blocks of planets. And there's a lot of olivine on Mars. When you react it with water in the right sort of conditions, you can get the methane given off. And because Mars's crust has got a lot of olivine in it, and there's quite a lot of possibilities for water to be reacting with that to give off that sort of methane, and to be able to potentially see that in the atmosphere and think, oh, maybe that's from some kind of biotic source.
So that's just because, so yeah, as you say, there's water that's just, or maybe ice, I guess, that maybe melts, touches some rock or gets in contact with the rock, has this this reaction, and the methane gets released. I know it's very low levels, right? So there's a lot of debate about quite how much there is and quite how variable it is.
There's definitely been some sort of controversy about how much there is and whether it's there at all. I think to start with, it was observed from Earth in sort of quite a famous publication, who spotted some in the atmosphere, which quite really just drove the trace gas orbiter mission, really, to sort of see it, if it was there. And now currently the Curiosity rover's got some detections of methane. It's sort of seen it around, sniffed it around. Whereas the trace gas orbiter instrument, which was specifically designed to sort of sense methane down to the parts per trillion level, I think, has not really found anything at all anywhere.
Interesting.
It's quite interesting that quite different results. I'm not sure quite how they're reconciled yet, but they don't have to be reconciled yet, because you know that's sort of science, isn't it? It's exploration.
But it narrows down the options, right? So that says there's probably not global methane if trace gas orbiter hasn't seen it. If there is some, it could still be these little pockets, could be very localized, just happens to have not been exactly where trace gas orbiter was looking. Or I mean, methane disappears pretty quickly on Mars. It gets broken down in the atmosphere, so it could be very transient.
Yes, it doesn't have a long residence time in the atmosphere at all.
So the fact that they've got inconsistent result, or the fact that they've got different results, doesn't mean they're inconsistent yet at all.
Yes, that's right. These inconsistent results don't mean that, you know, the question is over and one is right and one is definitely wrong. But as we go through time, over time, we'll build up more understanding and we'll probably be able to sort of narrow it down one way or the other.
You're listening to Pythagorean Astronomy, where we're exploring upcoming missions to Mars. While it's relatively easy to find people working on NASA and ESA missions from here, it's somewhat harder to get information about Chinese missions. So who better to speak to than someone who has their ear properly to the ground? Freelance journalist Andrew Jones. Andrew writes for a range of publications, Space News, Space.com and so on, where he reports on the Chinese space program. As I mentioned earlier, the Tianwen-1 mission builds upon quite a substantial space program from China. But we're not always that aware of it from here in the UK. The first thing I asked Andrew was to summarise the history of the Chinese space program, and it might be older than you think.
You can actually trace the Chinese space program back to before Sputnik. So you can go back to 1956 when the Chinese set up the first academy for space flight research. And that was basically trying to develop ballistic missiles so that they can eventually deliver nuclear payloads, just like the Soviet Union and the United States, just the same reasons why they were getting into rocketry. And that was given a big boost by the arrival of Chen Shui-sen, who was deported or exchanged from the United States back to China, back to his place of origin, should I say. So very, very early start. China's first launch then came in 1970. That was the first orbital launch with a Long March 1. They had had some early assistance from the Soviet Union, but that ended due to geopolitical tensions. So China, I think they were then the fourth country to put a satellite into space by themselves, and I think it was kind of the heaviest satellite for a first attempt. So they've got a long history, but it's only in the last 10 years or so that China's capabilities and launch rate and so on have really ramped up. So this time China had developed its own large spacecraft, which consists of both an orbiter and a rover and a landing platform to get it to the surface, and also launching this mission by itself. So it developed a new heavy lift launch vehicle, which demanded a lot of technological breakthroughs. And so we can just see, just by looking at China's history of interplanetary mission attempts, so going from a first one, which is piggyback, like 9, 10 years ago, to now being able to launch them themselves, then we can see it already kind of a big jump in capabilities.
So this new mission is Tianwen 1. Is that appropriate pronunciation?
Yeah, that's not bad. Yeah.
Excellent.
So, kind of questions to heaven. It's from a poem from before the Common Era.
If we think back to the previous first missions to Mars, then the NASA missions, the Soviet missions back in the 60s and so on, they were fairly basic missions in what they tried to do. And the same is true of any other sort of planetary exploration. Is the same true here? Is Tianwen 1 kind of a fairly basic mission, or is it much more ambitious than maybe those sort of 1960s were in comparison to what we see today?
Now, this is quite an ambitious mission, particularly for China itself, but also in an international context. There's nothing really easy about this. So China, there had been in the Chinese space community efforts to get a Mars mission approved earlier in the last decade, and particularly when India managed to put their own orbiter in orbit around Mars, that was kind of a wake-up call and a bit of a shock to China. So China's now looking to go beyond that. So not only are they going to have a fairly large orbiter with 7 science payloads on board for a multi-year mission in orbit around Mars, they're also combining this with a rover. So I think this we're talking about 5 tons altogether. So it's much larger than the India mission, much more capable. They will have to make an attempt at entry, descent, and landing, which only NASA has managed to fully succeed with so far. So the Soviet Union had managed to land and operate a lander for a few seconds, but that's it. That's the closest that another country has come to this. So China's had to develop a lot of technologies for this entry, descent, and landing, and these technologies have come from some things which they've been developing over the years. So the parachute you need for the first stage, that's being kind of derived from their experiences and technologies from the Shenzhou spacecraft, which you have, which they use to send astronauts up to low Earth orbit and back down safely. The heat shielding, again, is something that they are borrowing from. The propulsion for the landing is heritage from their Chang'e moon missions. And the same with the kind of the guidance and the altimetry and so on. So they're kind of building on what they've done before, but with Mars, landing on Mars could be much more challenging than the moon. On the moon, there's no atmosphere, so you don't have to worry about the heat shielding and the parachute to slow down, that kind of thing. Also, there's a distance, there's a slight time delay of a couple of seconds, like to the moon. But this, we're talking, a matter of minutes, tens of minutes, depending on how far away Mars and Earth are. So everything has to be automated for this. So this isn't something they'll be controlling from the ground. There'll be kind of a command sent, but then pretty much it's up to the landing platform to do the work remotely.
How is the mission kind of seen in China? Obviously, I'm aware that, the political structure in China is somewhat different to the States and to Europe and so on. How is this mission seen? Is there a lot of communication about it? Is this a build a sort of a great success for, for China as a sort of a almost a nationalistic kind of thing? How is it sold, if you like, at home in China?
Yeah, that's a very good question. The answers are kind of complex. It's a mix of cultural and political aspects to why they behave in the ways that they do. So, on the one hand, the Chinese space program is a symbol of what the Chinese Communist Party can achieve, which it likes to show to the public and say, look, this is what we're capable of. These tremendous feats, which eventually could match and surpass the United States. On the other hand, because it is this national symbol, they're very afraid of failure because of how that reflects on the leadership and so on. So, for example, normal launches, so around the world, like if it's a NASA launch or a commercial launch or an Indian launch, Japanese launch, you get a live stream. You only get a live stream in special circumstances in China, and even then they can be cut minutes before the launch is actually going to take place. They're very concerned about how this looks. So I think, I mean, it's that's not I mean that's an that's it's not too different from NASA in a sense. NASA always has this kind of public relations battle which it has to do. For example, if there would be a failure, if you look at the shuttle disasters, I mean, NASA has to be very careful about what it does and how it spends its money and how it succeeds. It's just that China takes it to a new level in terms of protecting itself and covering up the information that you get from the mission. So the orbiter should go into orbit around noon GMT on February 10. So they should be fairly confident about, performing the brake and maneuver to slow the spacecraft down to get into Mars orbit. That shouldn't be a big, obviously it's a major part, major moment in the mission, but it should be fine. The entry, descent, and landing, that's very challenging. So it'd be interesting to see how open they are when it comes to the time when that's going to happen and how much we know, or if we're just going to have to wait for a short announcement afterwards to say, yeah, we did it, or maybe a bit of silence to say, well, it didn't work. Typically they can be very terse when it comes to a failure. So it'd be interesting to see how much we know. They are publicizing it. For instance, they solicited suggestions for names for the rover back last summer, I think it was. So now they've released a short list of 10 names, and there's public voting, which will, I think, narrow it down to three names, and then there'll be a committee which decides on the final one. Interestingly, one of those can be translated to perseverance. So, that's interesting to see if that's the way the voting and the committee goes. So yeah, it's a kind of a balancing act of trying to show what they're doing and promote these things, but at the same time, not setting themselves up for failure.
China's actually got a pretty developed space program. It's got Chang'e 4 and U22 still going on the far side of the moon. It's got Chang'e 5 has sent a sample return from the moon. These must be hailed as huge achievements. And they are huge achievements, rightly so.
Yeah, absolutely. Chang'e 4 was very interesting in the sense that it was something that no one had done before. So China has been kind of racking up the accomplishments which have normally made it like the third country to achieve something after the United States and Soviet Union, right? And with this one, no one's landed on the far side of the moon. And to do that, they needed to put a relay satellite in a Lagrange orbit around a Lagrange point beyond the moon so that you could actually communicate with the far side of the moon because that never faces the Earth. So they put infrastructure in place and made the landing attempt. So, both that those were something that hadn't been done before and really put China on the map. There was a lot of surprise in America about China being able to do something like this, even though technologically it wasn't massively challenging. They'd landed on the near side of the moon, and the relay satellite itself wasn't groundbreaking. But no, to put this together, that was quite something. Chang'e 5 is a really complex mission. So there was four different spacecraft combined into this stack, which was sent to the moon. So you had an orbiter, a lander, and the sent vehicle, which would take the samples, which had been collected from the surface, back up into lunar orbit, and then they would need to have an automated rendezvous and docking in lunar orbit between the orbiter and this ascent vehicle, and then they needed to go back to Earth and release the return capsule and the orbit to come back had to be precise, the timing had to be precise, and then the capsule had to bounce off the atmosphere once because it was coming in so much faster than you would from low Earth orbit. So putting all of these things together, that was a really major step. It's also a signal that taking this complex path rather than, say, for example, the Soviet Union's lunar missions, they landed and launched straight back. So they skipped all this rendezvous and docking. So this is a signal that China's wanting to definitely look at a Mars sample return, maybe later this decade. But also then that's like practice for getting astronauts onto the surface and getting them back home. So there's, big steps made in the Chang'e 5 mission. So I think Chang'e 4, I think in what, last week, Lunar Day 26 ended, so I think it's like 750 days where these spacecraft have been, the Chang'e 4 lander and the U2 rover have been operating. So they've made a lot of very interesting science returns with regards to their detections on the surface, but also just the longevity and the managing to control the spacecraft on the surface of the moon for that long. It's impressive.
And have we seen much in terms of the science returns, published papers and published results and so on? Is much of that sort of coming out of these missions in the sort of what you might consider the sort of the normal academic way that these things come out?
Yeah, so there's for Chang'e 4, so that's the landing was it 2 years ago this month? Data's being released. They have a platform where they release data from the different science payloads and also occasionally images. They claim to have detected some material which may have originated from the lunar mantle, so below the crust. So that could tell us a lot about the history and evolution of the moon. They have a ground penetrating radar, which I think they've got two different frequencies which they're using to look, say, tens of meters and then hundreds of meters below the surface. And with this, they're detecting different layers of distinct lava flows. So again, that's giving insight into the evolution of the moon, of the surface and below the surface. I think some of these, they were linking some of these deeper lava flows to the Imbrian impacts and things like this. So, gaining lots of insights into how the moon formed and so on. Same with Chang'e 5. We haven't seen any science from that, but now that we have, what was it, 1.7 kilos of samples back on Earth, they'll be looking into the composition and so on. So we'll have lots of exciting science to come from that.
And you mentioned that these are kind of paving the way for sending astronauts to to the moon. The US and Europe have got this plan for Project Artemis and all sorts of plans to send astronauts back to the moon kind of this decade. Do you see any signs that there's a chance of this all combining together into instead of these kind of two, maybe arguably three different programs, there being one international program, or is there just not the political possibility of that at this stage?
No, at the moment, the geopolitical situation makes this extremely unlikely, I would say. Maybe we'd see something symbolic. So there are actually opportunities now to test how far China and NASA could actually cooperate. So, for example, the Chang'e 5 samples. So, given this kind of these barriers to NASA dealing with China, we could following how. Or how they don't cooperate in terms of sharing the Chang'e 5 samples. That's one thing to watch. Also, there is an interesting aspect to the InSight mission, which landed, when was it, 2018 or 2019 on Mars? So that's going to try to listen, in a sense, for the entry, descent, and landing of Perseverance. Okay,
Right.
so that would be scientifically very valuable. And there's an interesting paper about what InSight wants to do, which I can't really talk about in depth. It's very complicated. But the other thing is, if they can get good data on when the Tianwen-1 rover is going to make its landing attempt, then they could also make a detection attempt for that EDL, which should be, if we are correct on where they want to land, that would be closer to InSight, and that might be more scientifically valuable. So there would be an opportunity there for the two sides to kind of coordinate a bit. It doesn't take much in terms of cooperation. No one gets any secret technology, and it's just kind of, here you go. We can actually do a bit of science here, given the fact that we've already spent billions on these space missions.
And so given it brings us back to Mars and the immediate future, what kind of things are we going to see from, or what kind of experiments is the rover and Tianwen-1 going to be able to do? What kind of instrumentation has it got on board that it'll be able to do? And is it, how complementary or otherwise is it to things like Perseverance and other rovers there, Curiosity and so on?
Well, even if you had the same suite of instruments, it would be complementary just simply by being in a different landing site. Because, Mars is a big place. We've only landed there, a handful of times, really. So anything that they take is going to be very valuable. So they have a ground penetrating radar, which is similar to what they've had for the Chang'e 3 and Chang'e 4 rovers. So that, again, would give good insight into the geological history. What's, an insight into hundreds of meters down, what was going on, and maybe be able to discern different things that happened. So there hasn't been one of those put on Mars before. I think Perseverance has got one as well. So we're going to have these readings from two different places, which is going to be very, very valuable. There was actually tests in a kind of like a Mars analog site in the desert in China, where they used a similar kind of ground point. A science team used a similar ground penetrating radar, and they were able to detect pockets of water. So it's kind of theorized that in the landing zone, which they've marked out in Utopia Planitia, that there could be these kind of pockets of kind of very salty, briny pockets of water. So maybe the radar would be able to pick those up. So that would be very, very interesting. If they could find something like that, that would be a potential habitat for life. Extremophiles, but still, that would be, that'd be something very, very much worth following up. It has a laser-induced breakdown spectrometer, so like what Curiosity has. So that would be looking at the composition of rocks and so on. There's a multispectral camera for and a panoramic camera for taking images and also taking readings of the surface and so on. And I think it was six instruments. I think there's one related to climatology, and also there's a magnetometer, which would be kind of linking up with a magnetometer on the orbiter to kind of give, local and global readings of the magnetosphere and the atmosphere and the ionosphere and so on. So, yeah, it's a very well thought out and very valuable science mission.
It certainly sounds like it's something to look forward to, along with Perseverance. And of course, we have Hope, the mission from the United Arab Emirates, that's on its way there, and a similar kind of timescale as well. Do you know anything about Hope? Is that, again, we don't hear an awful lot about it. Is that anything you've heard about Hope mission and what that's got planned? That's a more basic mission, I believe.
Yeah, it's a very interesting mission. So I think there were institutes in America which were basically working on this mission. So the UAE was kind of funding this and developing some capabilities by doing this. But the Americans were, I think Columbia University, maybe Arizona as well, were involved in this heavily. And it was launched by Japan. So this is a very, very multinational mission, like most space missions are. So, but this is kind of a very, very good example of that. So, as for the science, they were not trivial. So it was again a very interesting mission, which is going to add to our understanding of Mars.
There's certainly a lot more to look forward to over the coming months and years, and in the next few weeks we look forward to the arrival of Perseverance, Tianwen-1 and Hope in February. Fingers crossed there'll be lots to talk about on the Red Planet in future episodes of Pythagorean Astronomy. But that's it for this month. My thanks to my guests, Dr. Peter Forden and Andrew Jones. Don't forget, you can subscribe to the podcast and find past episodes at pythagastro.uk, and you can also search for us on Spotify. Until next month, goodbye!
You've been listening to Pythagorean Astronomy, an extended version of this month's Astronomy Roundup from Pythagoras' Trousers, a weekly science and technology radio show presented by me, Rhys Phillips. You can catch up on full episodes of Pythagoras' Trousers, subscribe to our podcast and get in touch by going to www.pythagoras-trousers.radio.fm.